Welcome to episode 2 of the Reasonable Doubt podcast, where we discuss what it is that's reasonable to doubt, how to move beyond doubt and into certainty, and where to adopt agnosticism on certain positions. Joining me today is Professor Robert Alter. Dr. Alter is one of the most influential Hebrew scholars of the 21st century and a tenured professor at the University of Berkeley, California. He's best known for his groundbreaking work, The Art of Biblical Narrative, which single-handedly revolutionized the scholarly approach to Bible study. Alter argued that the documentary hypothesis was incapable of providing any analytic value to the study of the Bible, advocating instead for a literary approach, where the Bible is assumed to be one cohesive text, each book having a single author. Unsatisfied with contemporary English translations, Alter began translating the Bible from Hebrew to English, starting with selected writings and then moving into what would become a translation of the entire Hebrew Bible that he released in 2018. Alter argues that his translation better captures the poetry in the original Hebrew text and the flow of the words that is missing in contemporary English translations. Alter and I discuss the motivations behind his work on the Bible, the nuance and complexity of the Hebrew language, the difficulties associated with translating Hebrew to English, his analytic methodology, differences in translational modes, and the advances that we've made since the production of the King James Bible 400 years ago. The episode is only 25 minutes in length, but it was a productive and interesting conversation. But first, today's sponsor, Location Equipment. A cinematography and lighting and camera equipment rental company based in Perth. If you're working on your next film project, Location Equipment provide a variety of lighting and camera services and are Perth's go-to for all things filmmaking equipment, including the Aperture 120D Mark II that is lighting this video. I'm proud to say that I've used Location Equipment services since before the start of the podcast, and as a result, I can highly recommend them. For more information, go to www.locationequipment.com. With all that said, enjoy my conversation at the foot of the altar. Thanks for joining me, Dr. Alter. You're perhaps most well-known for your work with the Hebrew Bible. Can you tell me why that is and what it was that drew you to the Hebrew Bible and what your motivations were?
Well, I have to say my motivations are literary rather than religious.
Uh-huh.
The Hebrew Bible comprises some of the most extraordinary narratives composed in the whole ancient world. And then brilliant poetry from Psalms to the prophets, to the Song of Songs, to Job.
Mm-hmm.
And this always attracted me. Although I knew Biblical Hebrew well from, my late teens on. My formal training is in modern literature. So I have a graduate degree in comparative literature. And I had been reading the Bible in Hebrew and enchanted by it, but never thought it would be part of my professional work. And then about 15 years into my scholarly career, for various reasons, I wrote what I thought would be a one-off article on the need for a literary perspective on the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And it got a big response, many letters to the editor, some directed to me personally. And I thought, people seem interested in this. I have a few more ideas on biblical narrative. I'll write one more article. And the one article turned into four, and the four turned into a book on biblical narrative.
Right.
And at that point, I said to myself, I'm not really a Bible scholar, so I've got this off my chest.
Mm-hmm.
But then the narrative book got a big response, And amazingly, it's been in print continuously since 1981, which is very unusual for any book. So after that response, I thought, well, why not a book on biblical poetry? So I proceeded to do a book on biblical poetry. And then I was going down the slippery slope, and writing on the Bible became an important part of my professional work, although I never neglected modern literature. And I wrote on Kafka, on Flaubert, on Dickens, on the novel In the City, and so forth.
Yeah, that was really beautifully summarized. And so I just want to ask you, and you don't necessarily have to answer this if you don't want to, but I am curious to know if you do believe in God and if that in any way factors into your approach to the Bible or your reason for looking at the Bible at all.
I certainly don't believe in the kind of God who intervenes directly in history and in individual human affairs. And I suppose my relation to the Hebrew Bible comes from my sense of connection with the Jewish cultural tradition. That's about what I would say.
The art of biblical narrative advocates for a literary approach to the Bible, which views the Bible as a single cohesive text. At the time, the widely adopted approach seemed to be the documentary hypothesis. And your approach is, I guess, in some ways, it's quite similar to a Judeo-Christian approach. In the sense that it views the Bible as one cohesive text with a single author. And now your view on the authorship might be slightly different to that. But I guess what I'm getting at is that these approaches to the Bible seem kind of similar in a way. And I'm wondering if at the time of writing The Art of Biblical Narrative, there was a concern from you or maybe your contemporary colleagues that you might have been seen to have been reintroducing a religious perspective.
First, I'd like to modify what you said. I certainly have never thought that the Bible has a single author. It's whether or not one believes it's divinely inspired, it's a human production. And many different writers contributed to it. And
Of course.
also I concede, although I don't make it very important in my writing, that that many biblical texts are composite, that is, they draw together different sources. What I argued against was a kind of powerful atomistic impulse in biblical scholarship with a kind of unspoken slogan that the more atomistic, the more scientific. And that can lead to errors. And see, the very first thing I wrote on the Bible was an analysis of the story of Judah and Tamar in Genesis 38, which conventionally, at least at the time, had been spoken of as an interpolation in the Joseph story. As far back as Spinoza said it was an interpolation. And looking at it with literary eyes, I was struck by the elaborate interconnection between the, I won't go into the details here, between the Judah Tamar story and what preceded it and what followed it. And actually, after the fact, after I wrote this analysis of Genesis 38, I discovered that the classical Hebrew Midrash had done some of the same things that I did.
I guess that gets into an interesting point with your sort of view, is that you seem to, in a way, accept the documentary hypothesis, but you approach the Bible with this literary perspective, right?
Yeah.
And in your commentary, you occasionally draw attention to an inconsistency where you sort of attribute that to sources being stitched together.
Right.
And I'm wondering what your methodology is in order to identify the seams and where the seams would be located.
So sometimes the simplest thing is terminology. That doesn't always apply, but for example, when Joseph is sold into slavery, in one source he's sold to Midianites, and in another he's sold to Ishmaelites, and they're not the same people. So there's no way that I could see to resolve that logically. You just have to say that there are two different sources here. Or also from the Joseph story, the saddle packs of the brothers, in which they discover that their silver has been restored to them, are sometimes called, the word in the singular is sak, which actually is one of those rare biblical words that is cognate with Indo-European. It's the same word as sak. And sometimes it's called amtachat. And again, there would be no reason for the switching of terms, except that you have two different sources. Sometimes you get a linguistic, terminological clue. Sometimes there's simply an outright contradiction in what happens. In the rebellion again against Moses by Korah and his followers, how are they destroyed? At one moment they're burned up in fire, and another swallowed by the earth. It's hard to justify that in any literary terms or theological terms. It's because you have two sources that are put together.
I see. And so on the sources, could you tell me, I guess we've got the Masoretic texts, the Septuagint, and the Dead Sea Scrolls, and they're different sort of, I guess, translations of the Hebrew or manuscripts. And so
Right.
how is it that you go about reconciling the differences between those manuscripts, with regards to your own approach to the Bible?
That's a difficult methodological issue. The Septuagint, that's the very first translation of the Bible into Greek. And here and there, you can see that there's something that seems off in the received text, the Masoretic text. And in the Septuagint, there seems to be what seems to be off is on.
Right.
So at those points, you can infer that the Septuagint translators were working with a Hebrew text that at least at this point, not necessarily pervasively, but at least at this point, what was a better text than the one that became canonical in the Masoretic version. Well, the same is true with variants in the Dead Sea, the Qumran texts of the Bible that have been found. That is, there's no continuous text of the whole Hebrew Bible, but there parts of all the biblical books except Esther. So it's a little hard to sort out, but that is presumably when the grammarians of Tiberias, beginning maybe in the 7th century of the Common Era, started collating a what they felt would be a definitive Hebrew text of the Bible. They presumably had different manuscripts in front of them, and they made decisions, as editors do, of which was more authentic. And they probably made a lot of good decisions, and they made some questionable decisions. And you just have to use your judgment to decide whether a variant is right or wrong.
A lot of people have difficulty understanding how it was that we got the canonical scriptures for the Hebrew Bible. Can you tell me how we got the canon for the Hebrew Bible and why it's those specific books and not others? For example, the Apocrypha.
Right. Well, this was based on a series of decisions made by Jewish authorities, probably in the 1st century, maybe on into the 2nd century CE. There's a story in the Talmud that there was a meeting of the Sanhedrin, and the Sanhedrin declared which books went in and which went out. And Rabbi Akiva, oh, that would have been already the 2nd century, defended the inclusion of the Song of Songs by saying, if all the writings are holy, the Song of Songs is holy of holies, which meant, of course, he was reading it as an allegory of the love between God and Israel. Now, scholars think that that is a somewhat that conference of the Sanhedrin is somewhat is legendary, or is a legendary embellishment of what really went on. But in any case, all we know is that sometime around this period, let's say early 2nd century CE, decisions were made by rabbinical authorities, and that became the canon.
You are well known for having translated the entire Bible essentially from scratch. Oh, sorry, well, the Hebrew Bible specifically.
Sure.
What are the main problems that you saw in contemporary English translations that was missing? And how does your translation overcome some of those difficulties?
Okay, the main problem has two facets, which is the contemporary translations. Basically, they were done in the second half of the 20th century, run roughshod over the literary articulation of the text, which is very subtle, sometimes very powerful, and extremely important for the meaning of the text. And there are two reasons why the literary dimension of text was so badly treated. First, the scholars just didn't see it. That is, if you do a PhD in biblical studies at Harvard or Yale or the University of Chicago or Oxford or Cambridge, you will learn all kinds of important things, but you will never take a course in prose style in the Bible. And the treatment of poetic form will be sketchy and misguided. So that's one big problem. The other facet of that problem is that, alas, these learned committees, both in America and in England, have a tin ear for English usage. So you have misusages of English, you have a promiscuous mingling of different speech registers in English and so forth. So I, as a very literary person, with my eye to the literary shaping of the text, did my best to produce a translation that conveyed much of what was going on in the literary dimension of the Hebrew.
I have two final questions that I want to ask, if that's okay.
Sure, go ahead.
So, firstly, of the sort of one-man translations, if you will, you and Dr. Everett Fox are the two biggest names that come up in that sort of sphere. The obvious difference between your approach and his approach is that you seem to take a more poetic or literary sort of approach, and he seems to take a more oratory approach. And so, do you agree that that's the difference, or are there other differences that I'm missing that you might identify as well?
Yes, I'd say this, that what Everett Fox and I share is an aspiration to convey a good deal of the Hebrewness of the Hebrew. Where we differ is that Fox, following the model of Buber and Rosenzweig, feels that in order to do this, one should be able to violate normal English in many ways. Say, translating mizbeach, the word for altar, as slaughter site, in order to get the Hebrew root meaning slaughter that's in the Hebrew word Mizbeach, or to translate you shall not commit adultery, which is kind of clunky, as you shall not adulter, which of course gets the compactness of the Hebrew, which is just three syllables, altinaf, lotinaf, I'm sorry, but is not English. And so we're a part company from Fox, is that I think that these texts, which are beautifully idiomatic in their own language, are violated if they're transposed into an English version that is not idiomatic. Yeah, I guess that's what I would say.
Final question, I guess. I was reading your New York Times interview, and of all the English to Hebrew translations, you seem to be the most fond of the King James Version.
Yes, I am.
And I quite like the King James as well because it's quite, I like the archaic language and it feels quite sort of romantic and it's enjoyable to read. But
What do you think that translators understand now that perhaps was missing 400 years ago at the time that the King James Version was being produced?
I think we understand biblical Hebrew a good deal better than we did then. And by the way, the understanding of biblical Hebrew on the part of Christian humanists in the early 17th century was somewhat imperfect. That is, there are misconstructions of grammar and understanding of Hebrew words, which we understood then, which are wildly wrong. But mainly, there's been a big advance in the understanding of biblical Hebrew, partly because we've recovered all these cognate languages, which were not known in the Renaissance era. So that is a big difference. I would add the following, that nuance has not been a long suit in among Bible translators. And nuance, of course, is very important in literary expression. So when I worked on my translation, I tried to identify the exact nuance or linguistic register of terms, as well as just their lexical meaning, what you could find in a dictionary.
Dr. Alter, it's been half an hour. I just want to thank you so much for your time. And yeah, it's been a privilege talking to you, even though it hasn't been super long. But yeah, it's been enjoyable. And I've enjoyed having you on the podcast.
Okay, it's been good talking with you, and all best to you.